This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Will I get along with him? I have no idea.
He's a killer, though. Putin's a killer.
A lot of killers. We got a lot of killers. Why, you think our country's so innocent?
Welcome to Politics, a podcast about the continual coronation of Emperor Trump. My name is Tim Batt, and I live in New Zealand.
Hello, I'm Jeb Lund, and I live in Florida, but I'd like to think that I'm a citizen of the world.
Do you know what's going to unite the two of us, Jeb, what we're going to have in common very soon, is with a complete abandonment of science and a silencing of all climate change scientists and statisticians, you and I are going to be underwater, like, first. The places where we live are going to be the most screwed the most early, right?
Yeah, I think so. Like, my part of Florida is not as bad off as South Florida, like the Miami Beach area, but we're not far behind. You know, just getting an extra 10 feet of water will get you pretty far inland in this state. I actually thought you were going to say that we were going to have a lot in common because I was going to have to follow in the footsteps of many Silicon Valley billionaires like Peter Thiel and seek asylum in New Zealand.
That's our whole game plan. We're trying to produce a whole lot of propaganda showing how beautiful we are as a country to these billionaires, get them to bring their yachts over here, and then we're going to use their money and brain power to build an Atlantis-style escape pod, which will be under the ocean, which we will be very soon. So everything's coming up Millhouse over here. Come join us. The water isn't fine.
My suggestion, if I may, is what you do is you let them ship their yachts over there, then you nationalize their yachts, and then when they show up, you put them in detention camps and say that they're...
The yachts?
No, not the yachts.
Are we going to waterboard yachts? I don't think that's going to be effective.
Well, you can't waterboard a yacht. Most yachts have boards, and they're already...
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, I mean, it's like trying to sandblast a sandcastle. That's just Coles to Newcastle right there. I mean, why? Anyway, no, but what you do is you put the Silicon Valley billionaires in detention camps, and then you basically pretend that you never took their citizenship or accepted it and say that they are stateless actors because they're billionaires. Their billions immunize them from having to be citizens of really any nation and actually having any loyalty to anything, which is literally true. And then what they can do is they can appeal to somebody to get them out. And of course, because they won't have their yachts, they won't be able to escape. And we'll see how many people actually like them.
That's what people don't appreciate about rich people. You take away their yachts and they're powerless. They have nothing left. Jeb, this isn't what we were going to talk about first. What we were going to talk about first is you kept saying the words Trump-Flynn talk, and I didn't know what you were talking about. So on top of all the news that's happening this week, which we'll, I'm sure, get to in due course, let's lead with this. Tell me what is going on.
Okay, so it's an article that appeared in the Huffington Post about 2 hours and 6 minutes ago, titled "Leaks Suggest Trump's Own Team is Alarmed by His Conduct" by Christina Wilkie and this guy named SV Date, which I feel bad for the guy because I would just be like, hey, save the date, like all the time. Anyway, I'm not going to have to read very far, but this sort of accords with some things that you and I have been talking about in a previous episode. President Donald Trump was confused about the dollar. Was it a strong one that's good for the economy or a weak one? So he made a call, except not to any of the business leaders Trump brought into his administration or even to an old friend from his days in real estate. Instead, he called his national security advisor, retired Lieutenant General Michael Flynn, according to two sources familiar with Flynn's account of the incident. Flynn has a long record in counterintelligence, but not in macroeconomics, and he told Trump he didn't know, that it wasn't his area of expertise, and that, perhaps, Trump should talk to an economist instead. Trump was not thrilled with that response, but that may have been a function of the time of day. Trump had placed the call at 3 a.m. And then sort of it goes down, and there's another money quote here. I have been in this town for 26 years. I've never seen anything like this, said Elliot Cohen, a senior State Department official under President George W. Bush and a member of his National Security Council. I genuinely do not think this is a mentally healthy president.
Yeah. Yeah, that's full-on terrifying, Jeb. That's news to me. I'm just absorbing this for the first time now. And that is somewhere, I think, on the corner of insane and hilarious, but firmly in the district of it's really happening, so that's very terrifying. Elliot Cohen, correct me if I'm wrong, was the... he was part of Obama's security apparatus that... was part of a meeting, a preliminary meeting, to kind of okay the next phase of planning on the Yemen attack that happened, which Trump undertook. And he was basically the one who called out Trump for lying about how the Yemen attack was planned and okayed by the officials, right? That was a attack that a military strike against, I think, ISIS in Yemen, that was completely botched, which was figured out over a dinner table with Trump and Jared Kushner, and it ended up killing a Navy SEAL and an 8-year-old girl, and the target, who was supposed to be killed, escaped and is now taunting the Trump administration, sending out audio messages, and basically ISIS is using it as propaganda. That's that, Cohen, right?
I don't believe so, but I mean, at this point, like, there are so many, you know, I mean, like, that name, there's so many retreads that keep coming through. So, like, you know, this is Elliot Cohen. Elliot Abrams is now part of, like, being considered for the Trump team. And then he goes back multiple administrations. And I don't believe that, I mean, that Cohen had any involvement in that. He might have called it out on Twitter, but I don't think he would have been on the planning staff just because of,
there was someone part of Obama's team who was part of, like, basically what happened is, this is my understanding, the Yemen attack happened, it was a failure, the news got out about it, and then Trump said it was Obama's team that okayed this, and Sean Spicer said that it was authorized without any problems whatsoever and sent all the way to the top. It didn't have to kind of go through any further planning phases or okaying phases. And I'm trying to remember the name of the guy, but it's someone, Cohen, who was part of the Obama administration and the security apparatus, was like, that is bullshit. I was part of those early planning meetings, and what we okayed was for it to go through a proper procedure of basically being vetted for its potential to be successful among intelligence folks, not to be decided on over a dinner table, which is what happened, and then it failed. But yeah, maybe they're two different guys.
We can certainly look it up at the break. But I mean, that planning too is like part of the same kind of sphere of things to be frightened about, because this is, you know, it's a big, in addition to the people you mentioned, there were 15 other women and children were killed in that raid. Exactly as you said, the final preparations for that were okayed at a dinner with his son-in-law, Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, whose writers at the New York Observer admitted, like, anonymously, that they literally had to dumb down their stories so that he could understand them. Bannon was supposedly at it, and this was not held in like a full briefing of generals. This was just over a dinner. And then combined with the other things that have happened recently with Trump, called up Malcolm Turnbull, the PM of Australia, and essentially just started lying to him about his amazing electoral college victory and this total landslide he had, and then started berating Turnbull for an agreement that was already existing between Australia and the Obama administration for America to take some of the refugees that were being held in Australia. And then he allegedly, that was the initial report, was that he just hung up on him because he was fatigued. It was 5 p.m. And kind of like, as we'd said before, you know, if you know, you've had a family member who has Alzheimer's and people start getting tired and irritable and not able to focus at 5 p.m., that's a thing called sundowning. And there are so many things that this president does that make me think, oh, shit, this guy is sundowning.
But then getting up at 3 a.m. to question whether or not a a strong US dollar is a good thing or not. I'll just put it in right now so we don't have to revisit it later. I've just Googled it, and the national security official from the Obama administration's name was Colin Kahl, K-A-H-L. He disputed Spicer's description of the planning Thursday evening. Kahl in tweets shared hundreds of times said that the Department of Defense worked up a general proposal that asked for authorities to do raids in Yemen, but that the mission carried out Saturday was not specifically a part of that. Then President Obama did not make any decisions because he thought it represented an expansion in the war in Yemen and believed the Trump administration should assess how to proceed. And that's from the Washington Post from earlier this week. I think that assessment of, if you look objectively at the actions carried out by this man, and it's always, you know, just a little too tantalizing and a little too low-hanging fruit to play armchair psychologist to the most powerful man in the world. But I was thinking about this week, that he does seem to be exhibiting signs of at least a diagnosable personality disorder, and if not, mental illness.
I think the personality disorder is diagnosable from 10 years back, but or more. But yeah, like the constant irritability, the inability. Like, so this article goes on to stress that he cannot read long briefing papers. He insists on having everything in a one-page summary. He otherwise doesn't read. He watches TV to see what is being said about himself, which, if you wanted to be really sinister, this is a guy kind of piecing his own memory back together like Memento, or otherwise shows somebody who is incapable of sustained thought on any given issue, both of which are terrifying. I mean, you know, the old story in the Reagan White House was when they wanted to get him to understand briefings, they would just make movies for him. And so they would wheel in the projector and the movie.
Is that
true? Yes. Yes, that is.
Oh, wow.
Like, so when they would say, like, you know, we need this bomber or something, and they couldn't quite persuade him of the utility of a bomber, they would bring in a clearly made film strip from, you know, the whatever guy in DOD liaised with whatever contractor or something. And then in addition to that, he was sometimes given instructions on what to do, like stage directions, blocking, you know, over and above the stuff that a president needs to know for security. It's, you know, here, pause, wave, etc. And so he was managed as this, you know, essentially figurehead because his mind wasn't all there. And
yeah, I mean, he did have dementia, though, towards the end of while he was still serving, though, right? Like, that's on the record.
We did sort of talk about this before. If I remember correctly, Nancy Reagan never admitted that he had suffered dementia as president, but if you go back and watch that first debate with Walter Mondale in 84, that's a man who doesn't know where he is. And oof. Yeah, but the whole film strip thing, I mean, these problems, you know, predated that, if I remember correctly. And in any event, like, if you want to believe that they're both perfectly mentally fine, the fact that you've now got a president who can't understand an issue or refuses to understand it unless it is summarized to him as like one page bullet points, and is getting all his news from watching fucking Mika Brzezinski and Joe Scarborough, like, you know, live action Beaker from the Muppets.
I'm going to attempt to push back here, and here's why. When George W. Bush was in power, he was characterized universally as being this complete moron, and was depicted often in political cartoons and stuff as being a monkey, and he was always seen as this kind of childlike, idiotic figure. And I think that with the fullness of time, and I guess people get a little rose-tinted and nostalgic about past presidents, maybe even, you know, to an absurd degree, but I think there has been a more full appreciation that George W. Bush was not an unintelligent man. I think he was led astray by some villains, and I think that because he didn't have the ability to kind of push back against those voices like Rumsfeld and Cheney, he was led down some really dark paths. But I don't think the guy was nearly as stupid as he was characterized to be in the media at the time while the wars in the Middle East were failing. And so that's why I'm like a little bit nervous about just jumping on board, you know, the hype train, along with characterizing Trump as this mentally ill dude, just because it's a very popular point of view at the moment. He could just be shit. He doesn't have to be crazy.
Well, I mean, but there's this strain in journalism and also in among leftists in America of basically, you know, every Republican president since Eisenhower has, with the exception of Ford and H.W. Bush, has gotten progressively more evil. You know, you go Nixon to Reagan to W to Trump, and they get more conservative and more rightward. And so what happens is as soon as you get the new model that ramps up the evil and stupid and cranks down the sympathy, you go, boy, you know, the previous one was not a bad guy. And I mean, I remember Nixon being rehabilitated conversationally by my parents during or by adults, I should say, during the Reagan administration. Well, like, look, you know, just give us that guy again. You know, he was a sharp one. And then W was like, well, listen, you know, Reagan, he at least raised some taxes and he could reach across the aisle. And then now with W, it's like, well, listen, he was a humane guy who didn't say that all Muslims were basically murderers in waiting. But like, you know, I remember on the day that, the week before he left office, I got one of these like email forwards, and it was like 15 images strung together, and they were just all large type things that had happened, pardon me, during the Bush administration that, you know, by then I'd even managed to forget about, but just the sheer litany of contempt, for the democratic process and for, you know, people who are not rich was so huge. And I'd forgotten that even during the presidency. And now I probably couldn't list, a full 3-4 pages of that. I would still have 11 to go. As we forget these things, some of the horrors that we just wish to forget go away, because we're no longer immersed in it. I think we tend to lessen it. And the other thing I would say against that is that I think everybody pretty much, like, with the exception of mainstream, media personalities who can't editorialize out of the gate, I think everybody was saying that Donald Trump was a spectacularly stupid human being with some really weird pathological behavior back in 2015. It's just that now all that is manifesting in ways that can manipulate vast amounts of power.
Yeah, well, when you've got a support base that will almost be rallied by the fact that someone who they perceive as their own, which is ironic, is you know, being yelled at for being a racist, being Islamophobic, being homophobic, that, you know, it almost gives the opposite effect to what was intended by calling that person and their policies out and their rhetoric. And here we all are, living in that result.
Except for you, you get to be far distant, and I think we were going to do a bit on that. Do you want to take a minute and come back?
Yeah, let's do that. Right. After this short break, where we will hear a sample of Betsy DeVos, newly minted Secretary of Education, we're going to talk about the international feeling towards U.S. President Trump.
You can't say definitively today that guns shouldn't be in schools?
Well, I will refer back to Senator Enzi and the school that he was talking about in Wapiti, Wyoming. I think probably there, I would imagine that there's probably a gun in the school to protect from potential grizzlies.
As an American, I know that there are very few things outside of our borders. I know that there are cheaper prescription drugs in Canada and cheaper all the other kind of drugs in Mexico. I know that Europe is the place where many of the pornographers come from, and pretty much everything else is Ocean and Rand McNally, and luckily in my case, where Tim is. What interests me, because I'm immersed in this every day, is the perspective of somebody who gets to do it voluntarily and gets to walk around and have media and commentators around him that have accented English and don't have to obsess about President Trump. So my question to you, Tim, is how you doing out there?
I'm doing all right. Unfortunately, even though we did flag this, that we were going to try and talk about it last week, I kind of forgot that. And in my head, I kind of tend to immerse myself a lot more than the average bear with American media and American commentary. But you can't help but absorb by osmosis the place that you're in. And in New Zealand, I feel like in some respects, we're only just now able to think about other things and dedicate our front pages to things that aren't Trump. That being said, it actually was busy, so I missed it, but there was a march, and I'm not sure how big it was, last night in Auckland, the city that I live in. I'm not sure how big the numbers were, but that was specifically against the Muslim ban. So the protests and stuff are still happening internationally, and I think that's important to note.
I have a question about that really yeah. quickly. Is there a sense of, is there a sense of futility or something that you need to get past to go marching about the president of another country? Because I think, you know, Americans just don't do that. Like we don't, you know, there'll be in the larger cities, you know, you can get enough. There's enough population density that you can get a bunch of Chileans together who could go demonstrate in like, you know, Tompkins Square Park or something about Augusto Pinochet. But, you know, I just think that that's kind of alien to a lot of American mindset, of like, I'm going to go to a public square in my nation to talk about the leader of another nation. I mean, is that.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I think probably the way that. I think New Zealand is like this. I think Australia is like this. I think there's probably some other countries in the West that are like this as well. They're a little smaller like us. That American exceptionalism thing, I think we tacitly agree with it, even though we constantly bemoan the Americans, and it's very popular for us to kind of have jokes against Americans and to kind of universally hate Americans because they're the big, powerful country. When we protest against Trump in New Zealand, it's not against just another leader of a country. It's like America is a very different kettle of fish from any other country in the world. And I use American exceptionalism, which is kind of funny because that's what the Republicans have been sort of using as a turn of phrase for so many decades now. And I think the rest of the world actually agrees with that in some respects a lot more than, for example, certain parts of the Democratic Party, and also Trump himself. I was actually just listening to some comments today that he shirks that label of American exceptionalism, which is something we won't get into now. But America is different. America is the leader of the world, and I think we all respect that. And like any leader of the world, because we live in democracies, we are open to ridicule it, and we have our fun, and we have our jokes, and we have our commentary. But I think during the Obama era, we had 8 years of really respecting this world leader where all the top line stuff seemed fantastic. And because we weren't part of the sort of integrated fabric of the country itself, we didn't get enough exposure from the outside looking in to some of the bad stuff, to some of the nuances of how Obamacare didn't work out so well for certain people. We just kind of saw this historic African-American leader of America in the early 2000s, which was an amazing thing, like turn of the 21st century, and they've got a black president, and he's articulate and rousing and progressive and a cool guy. And so to go from George W. Bush as like a president that even when I was a teenager, I was marching against the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. Like I was marching in Wellington up to Parliament against that stuff when I was in high school. So we had this period of kind of really hating the leader and then loving the leader. And now we're back even further now that Trump's in charge. But the one thing that doesn't change, and I think this is true of a lot of countries around the world, is we've always got to respect the might and the power, and not just like economically or militarily, but the cultural importance of America is like really inescapable.
I guess maybe that wouldn't occur to me. I probably would have occurred to me if I thought about it before asking the question, but I'm trying to ask you the amiable, I don't know the answer, just tell me kind of question.
But, yeah, you're playing the audience surrogate.
Yeah. But also like, just as an American, like it wouldn't even occur to me to think the way you might think, because why would I not think like an American the best way of thinking possible?
Right? But that's the thing. Like, I think that a lot of people in the left in America it's tricky. I don't know if I'm going to articulate this correctly, but it's like, I think we've got a more rose-tinted vision of America, which is more similar to how the Republicans and the conservatives view their home country than people on a lot of people on the left do in America.
I think if you judge by outward rhetoric, that's fair. And there's certainly a lot of elements of the left here that have a kind of cheerless oppositional attitude toward the United States. I've never been one of those people. I definitely will at the right moment get all, my eyes will well up at a national anthem, at a sporting event or something, or I'll occasionally watch like CNN's The 60s, which is just basically, or the 80s or whatever, and it's as much CNN footage as they can manage. And I'll see something and I'll be like, yeah, good on you, America. and like, long may she wave. But I think a lot of that from the left comes from just needing to push back against the that American exceptionalism attitude of conservatives that admits no error. I mean, when you have the Texas Board of Education, which is large enough, they buy enough textbooks that essentially textbook makers adapt their text to meet with the Texas BOE's approval, because that way they can sell more books. When they basically try to take slavery out of American history texts, or when they do engage with it, go, many slaves were happy, they had a great old time, and the American Indian is somebody that, yes, well, we may not have honored some treaties, but they have their own reservations now, and the whole subject of genocide doesn't exist. Or where, like Jesus divinely inspires the Constitution, and it makes you just have to be like, no, look, we're a genociding bunch of slave owners who basically wrote this beautiful, infallible document to enshrine land as having more power than people. And so you wind up with this really churlish sounding attitude, but it's not the totality of your belief. It's just you have to keep throwing that out there, because otherwise you just get drowned in this ahistorical hogwash and endless apologia that is being marshaled to defend something even more odious in the future.
It's so interesting that you bring that up, because we've just celebrated, well, some people would say celebrated, other people would say commemorated, Waitangi Day in New Zealand. So in the same way that America is a nation that was founded by guns, and this is, I have a lot of arguments with my friends who like, I'll give you an example. One of my friends posted on Facebook recently a video of a young girl who looks to be about maybe 11 or 12 years old, and she's unfurling a birthday present, and it's a rifle of some description. She's got tears streaming down her eyes. She's so happy that it's there. And it was just comment after comment of New Zealand person saying, this is so fucked up. What the fuck? What the hell is this? They're sick. They're mental. Da-da-da. I'm like, here's the thing, because I'm kind of a contrarian anyway, so I'll just say stuff like this even if I don't necessarily believe it, just to test the water. But with guns, I actually think we do have kind of quite different attitudes about it, and I think that the American viewpoint deserves a little bit of respect and context around it. But what I was trying to say to people during that, on that thread, was our experience of guns, especially Americans with guns, is so tied into like school shootings and media coverage of people going mental and killing each other with them, that is our exposure to firearms. We don't see them out and about in the streets. We don't really see them anywhere unless you live in the country on farms and stuff, where you go rabbit shooting and that sort of thing. So we the average New Zealander, we are really urban based, and we do not have an experience with guns whatsoever. Whereas in a lot of states in America, like Texas, for example, it's like very much part of the culture. You go down to the range, it's like a thing you do with your family, you learn gun safety, you learn how to shoot it properly. And in the same way that, we learn sport and we grow up with rugby here in New Zealand, there are some families that do the same thing with guns. And a lot of people are going to say, yeah, that's a false equivalence, because one of them's a goddamn weapon that you're using for sport, and the other one is a
firearm.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Pig's bladder on a pig's bladder on a bit of grass, but just the experience of guns is different. And sorry, all of this to say, we just had our National Day, Waitangi Day, and that is in commemoration of the fact that in 1840, New Zealand, the British settlers who came here signed a treaty called the Treaty of Waitangi with a collective of the native people of New Zealand, the Māori. And we've got so much national shame about it that we can't really celebrate it as a national day in the way that you guys do with Thanksgiving. Even though if we're going to go an apples for apples comparison, we've got way less blood on our hands. I won't get into the kind of minutiae of the land wars and the history that we've got. But you know, it's that age-old story. The white people did come here and kind of fuck over the brown-skinned people who were here first. But we did it to a lesser extent, for sure, than the Americans did. But we have
you could just start shouting, we learned it by watching you, and, you know, like all... As an American raised on that public service announcement, I 100% get that.
I think there is some natural benefit that we never talk about here, but to the fact that it happened in 1840. So it actually did happen a long time after other places had been settled. So the kind of dominant European viewpoints of the native savages could have evolved a little bit by the time we actually started to become a nation. But we've got an awful history as well. Every country, I think, that's been dominated by the British Empire has got this awful history of coming in, fucking over the native people. And America seems like the best country in the world at brushing past that and just not thinking about it or talking about it. And yet New Zealand, I think we do carry a real shame in our psyche and in our national DNA about it. And I don't think that's the worst thing in the world, because I think the alternative is that you pretend like it didn't happen.
Yeah, and I mean, to me, like, I can enjoy Thanksgiving. I was a history major, and I can still enjoy Thanksgiving. It's not easy to have studied history and have a great time outdoors in this country, you know, in any place that is recognizable and was written about in a, you know, like a history text. Because there's probably going to be something there that's pretty atrocious. I mean, the state that I live in was just went gangbusters during Jim Crow. You know, it doesn't make it less beautiful naturally, you know, and you can't, it doesn't inhibit my ability to appreciate and celebrate the aspirational things that we try to tell ourselves about ourselves at Thanksgiving or, you know, on certain holidays. But I feel like, you know, if you don't know your own history, how can you possibly improve on it? If we're going to pretend that everything was fine then, what incentive do we have to do to fix anything now if we can just say, well, hey, we'll just wait 20 years and most of the people who were victims of this will die out and then we can pretend it didn't happen.
So then here's my question to you. Do you think that that unabashed patriotism that I think can only happen by compartmentalizing things like Thanksgiving and what its origins are, do you see that is unhelpful? Like, by your own admission of going, I can enjoy Thanksgiving, it's, you know, I can enjoy taking a break to enjoy the things around me, the natural beauty, my family, and that sort of thing, but also recognizing that it's got this atrocious kind of origin and history to it. Do you not see an issue with that?
Well, I think maybe the issue would be that my willingness to applaud myself for my savvy, perhaps inhibits my willingness to go out and do something, actually productive about, you know, seeking some sort of like remediation for this past sin. I won't claim to have reached apex wokeness or something from that, but I think, you know, I'm generally suspicious of somebody who doesn't struggle with kind of, dichotomous ideas about their own country in their head. You know, if you are wholly on board with exactly one narrative, I'm a little worried about you.
I think that's healthy. I think that's, and that doesn't have to be unproductive as well. in either direction, in like a kind of progressive agenda sense of the word, or in enjoying the things around you without having to be on antidepressants all the time, kind of a sense. Getting back to the original kind of point in question, though, I think the international experience of Trump so far, it genuinely has shaken the rest of the world. I think people were shocked. Like on our 21st of January, because we were a day ahead of you guys, we were just like, holy fuck. And the recent episode, particularly in our neck of the woods, with what happened with Malcolm Turnbull, the Prime Minister of Australia, with his first call with Trump, where Trump ended up hanging up on him, as you were mentioning earlier, like that was the front page of every newspaper, even here in New Zealand. And I saw all of the big Australian ones as well, Sydney Morning Herald, all the big papers in Melbourne. That's a big thing for us, for all of us.
And that guy's a massive asshole too, right?
It's interesting. Malcolm Turnbull is a pretty big asshole, but because they just had Tony Abbott, everyone's kind of desensitized and little bit grateful that he's not there anymore. So it's
it happens to them too, I should say.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, Tony Abbott was an enormous piece of shit. Like, a terrible, terrible man. We just had our first phone call. Bill English, who's our, I think his official title is acting prime minister at the moment, because our leader, John Key, just stepped down because he got bored of winning all the time. he got the phone call, I think it was like maybe just before or after the Super Bowl, because it was on our Waitangi Day. So he had to like just mission into a car to take the call. There's some photos of Bill English on the phone to him. But and I know this is a drop in the ocean of things that are going on at the moment. But again, I was just like, fucking, don't they usually figure out times with these sorts of things? Like, aren't there people, middlemen and diplomats and things that go, okay, we better not call on this day because it's their national day of commemorating the treaty that made them a nation state. So he's probably going to be at the marae and doing certain ceremonies with the Māori and that sort of stuff. But he just had to like duck into a car at a random point in the day and talk to Trump for like 15 minutes about probably how great Trump is, I imagine.
Yeah, God. Well, first of all, I assume the briefing book that he has been prepared by Stephen Miller and Steve Bannon. So like every record of that day has been purged from it. I mean, if it shows up, it's probably like New Zealand baller day. Everybody go out and act like a baller. Okay, well,
The big story that I hope the rest of the world, like, I guess New Zealand and Australia and places like us and in Britain, that we start paying more attention to, I've got to say, Theresa May is doing her absolute best to normalise Trump and the GOP to get in with them at the moment. But I hope that one role that we can play as the rest of the world is by calling out this fucking crazy developing relationship between the White House, specifically, I won't say America, between Trump and Russia and Putin. Because that is just like very scary and unsettling and odd. And I think he, out of all of the phone calls that he made in his sort of like 3 days of calling all the national leaders around the place and catching up with all of them personally, the Russia phone call was an hour, and it's the only one there's no record of, because they said that the machine wasn't working. Like, that's fucking crazy. These are the same guys who are making all these conspiracy theories based on very little, and yet, like, here's a real crazy thing that's happening and developing before our eyes. And I think that we need to pay way more attention to it.
See, actually, it's funny that the Russia thing is bigger for you than it is for me. Because I don't know, maybe this is just me grasping at straws or God, I use this expression a lot, whistling past the graveyard. But like the thing I almost hope more is that every other nation on earth just constantly, like, I hope that there's just a column in every newspaper around the globe that just goes like, shit Trump made up today. Cause I'm not so much worried about what he's going to do with Russia, because I think it ultimately is a lot more limited than we imagine. But just the idea that, like, if the Trump administration goes to war with the idea of journalism and fact with as much relentlessness as it has shown so far, I just want there to be a record out there. So we, you know, maybe as like a thing of last resort, you can take somebody and go look at literally any other newspaper in the world. Mm. Like CNN's fake news. Well, how the fuck did CNN buy New Zealand? Like,
Totally get that. And that is a lovely vision of what hopefully will happen. Here's the problem with it. And maybe we should wrap this, this bit of the show on this. Is that I think the world over, journalism has been in the last 20 years in this race to the bottom of, and I think part, I mean, this is just me guessing at this point, but I think they fucked up how to put news online and make money from it without just destroying their own business models. And I think journalism was in this race to the bottom of generating shareable content online, which generates so little revenue, and getting a big TV audience for very light, fluffy shows, because that's the people who were left watching TV to get these broad audiences. And so everyone started going more and more base. They started cutting all the journalism staffs, paying the people who were there less and less, which just removes any drive for any career journalists who have been in the game doing the real gumshoe, like hard-nosed investigative reporting, to stick around. So they all leave, and what you're left with, and this isn't just America, this is everywhere, is a lot of very young, inexperienced people running the majority of newsrooms now. And in New Zealand, like, parliaments and governments are hard to understand. I barely understand New Zealand's. I definitely don't understand America's, and I'm very interested in it, but they're very complicated institutions. They
it's called Congress here. I'm going to throw that out there.
The podcast into civics lessons. Not going to get it at school anymore because Betsy DeVos is here, we're going to take it upon ourselves.
America has a bicameral legislature.
So I hope you're right, and I don't think you are. I think you're being too optimistic about what the newspapers are going to report on, because I think it's so easy to get a tweet that Trump sends out and turn that into column inches, and it's so hard to look at what he's actually doing at a policy level and turn that into a story, because you have to understand and be able to communicate so much context to an audience around that. So I think that's a big danger. And the silver lining, of course, is that because Darth Vader is now in charge of the nukes, a lot of people have been throwing money at different journalistic outfits, which is arming them back up, which is, it's sad that it had to get to this, but it's nice that eventually people have kind of woken up to that.
Man, all that just makes me want to really argue about journalism, and like, there just isn't time for that. besides, we can come back to this probably forever.
And we should.
Yeah.
But I think for now, Jeb, this has been a pretty broad one. I don't know if we've got time for another segment, but should I just maybe throw a little bit of the tidbits of what's been happening in the news this week, and we'll just have a real quick convo on that to round off on?
Sure, yeah.
So Judge Neil Gorsuch has been nominated by President Trump, and he's 49 years old. He's a federal court judge from Colorado. He's been nominated as the new Supreme Court replacement for Antonin Scalia, who died this time last year. So for those listening in places like New Zealand, what's supposed to happen is when a Supreme Court judge dies, you usher in a new one pretty fucking quickly. The president puts forward their nominee and then the Senate votes on it. Mitch McConnell, who was the Senate majority leader, decided to hold it up because it was election year. Which, was that literally without precedent? Like, had that ever happened before?
No. So basically, McConnell's argument was the American people deserve to vote on who their next Supreme Court justice would be. And the thing is, they did. They did in 2012. They voted for Barack Obama and they said, we want this person to nominate Supreme Court justices. So the Republican Party said, well, it's unprecedented to nominate and then confirm a Supreme Court justice in an election year. And then, of course, basically every print and TV outlet and every Democrat went, come again? No. In fact, here are all the times that it had happened. So basically they were just betting that
that they could do it.
that, you know, what it was, so, you know, Obama nominates Merrick Garland, Merrick, like John Merrick from the Elephant Man, Garland, who is basically a moderate. You know, this is a guy who could have been nominated by a Republican 40 years ago. You know, that's how the Republican Party has drifted.
Sorry to interrupt, but there were even Republicans on the record last year before Obama announced who his nominee would be, saying that Merrick Garland would be a fine choice. And then once it was Obama's idea and he formally announced, then they withdrew their support for his nomination.
One of them, if I remember correctly, was current Supreme Court nominee Neil Gorsuch. So, so anyway, what they did was they just bet that, you know, well, Hillary Clinton will lose and then we'll get a Republican and we can nominate. And if she doesn't lose, we'll just obstruct her forever. And in fact, you know, good mavericks that the Democrats are relying on to step up to Trump, like John McCain, said, well, we're going to oppose her and stonewall her as much as possible. We're not going to let Hillary Clinton have a nominee. So, I mean, if Hillary Clinton were president now, there's no guarantee that they would have voted on Merrick Garland. They might have just said, like, hey, we'll just wait another 4 years and hope that you're one termer.
Sorry, I didn't understand that. You don't think that's hyperbole?
I
view of the GOP.
I think anybody who thinks that the GOP is going to continue to play by any rules whatsoever unless they're compelled to by being outmaneuvered and outnumbered is kidding themselves. The GOP, I don't think, has any real ethical, moral, or principled guidance other than the complete hoovering of money out of the working and middle class toward the top 1%. And anything that will accomplish that will be done to see it done. And I think the sooner the Democratic Party realizes that, essentially, from a legislative standpoint, they are in a street fight, and until they realize that, everything they do is going to be a complete goddamn waste of time.
The trouble is Judge Gorsuch is 49 years old. And he looks good, too. I reckon the guy's going to live to be 100 years old, which means...
Yeah, thanks.
Because the Supreme Court judges, they're just there indefinitely. Nothing can remove them, right? They have to die or quit.
They can be impeached. But that would require the Congress to impeach him. So you would need a simple majority, simple Democratic majority in the House, and then... two-thirds Democratic majority in the Senate. And then, of course, he would actually have to commit some sort of high crime to do it.
Jeb, no one's impeaching that man. He's too good looking. Some other stuff briefly that happened. What has happened to do with the Muslim ban might have changed just in the time that Jeb and I have been speaking. But if you're just kind of trying to figure out what's happened so far, there was an executive order that came down from the White House that we're pretty sure Steve Bannon wrote and that Trump signed, which temporarily banned immigrants from 7 majority Muslim countries, and people immigrating from Syria banned them indefinitely. That order came down. Then the acting attorney general, Sally Yates, announced that the Department of Justice would not be legally defending the order because she didn't believe in its constitutionality. Then Trump fired her, and then a U.S. district court judge from Seattle put a pause on it, again questioning its constitutionality, and now it's in a court who are expected to rule on whether or not the ban will remain in place, and we're just waiting to hear back any second now. Have I sort of roughly characterized that correctly?
So just to add a couple of things, Yates declined to enforce it, in part because it had gotten its shit stomped in federal court. And I don't know if it was 0-5 at that point, but it was definitely an offer. It still hasn't won in federal court. I think actually there might have been one ruling in Boston. I'm not sure. I know that a judge was sympathetic to the Trump administration, but I can't remember what his actual ruling was. But at the time, it had not won. And an attorney general has the discretion to say, if I believe this is an unworkable law that is fundamentally flawed and a court will find it such, the attorney general has discretion not to waste time and money doing that. that's her prerogative. It was Trump's prerogative to fire her. You write about the Seattle judge staying the order nationwide. That's now gone down to the district court, if I remember, or circuit court in California. And that's a 3-judge panel. 2 of them are Democratic. 1 was appointed by Bush, if I remember correctly. And they're going to, they had the hearing for it was today, but the ruling will probably not be out until Friday, or maybe the weekend. So we won't know how they voted yet. The petition, I'm sorry, well, ask your question. Sorry.
I was just going to say, I mean, shit, I have no understanding of how this works with the court system in the States. And we're getting into very complicated terrain now where I feel like everyone's finding out these new bits of the institution as this thing pushes through. But do you yourself know what happens either way, if either the stay is upheld in this court decision, or if it's struck down, does it go, can it go to another court? Does it go to a court of appeals? Like, where does it go?
If they uphold the stay, it will go to the Supreme Court, which, given that it's a 4-4 split on conservative to, I won't even say liberal, but just centrist and then slightly left, if that's a tie, then it gets punted down to the circuit court's ruling, which, you know, if they're upholding the original district court ruling, then that would be binding. So the EO would fail on those accounts. So right. If the circuit court finds that the district court is in error, they can overturn it, but they can also make recommendations. If I remember correctly, I mean, that's the thing is that, you know, everybody, like every journalist, it's always funny, like when these things happen, because, you know, you've got the people whose normal beat is like, well, I cover, you know, LGBTQ affairs in Washington, and then, you know, they got to get on Twitter and have something to say about this. And then usually they figure out how the appellate system works again by waiting for Ari Melber to tweet like an explanation. And I mean, I used to know this like back to front, thanks to college and you know, government courses. And now I'm kind of in the same boat where I have to relearn the process every time.
Well, like, oh, yeah, that's it, right. It's like an absolute shitstorm. So anyone who does know how it works, my hat goes off to them. A couple of other short bits of news just as we wrap up. Nancy DeVos, who we talked about last episode, she's in. Hooray. It was a completely split decision. And so Vice President Pence went down as the president of the Senate and cast the deciding vote to make her the Secretary of Education of America, which is just great news. Just great news for everybody, especially the youth. And, I should mention as well, to do with the Muslim ban, that Trump sent out a series of tweets. I'm assuming in the middle of the night, I can't remember the time code on those ones, but basically saying that he couldn't understand how the courts, one different and equal branch of government outside of himself, could have this much power, and that if there's a terrorist attack, we should all blame that judge who put a stay on the executive order. So that's responsible leadership for you.
Well, yeah, I mean, and if your goal is to make yourself the sole legitimate authority in the United States, you're doing a really great job of that with that kind of attitude by basically trying to turn citizens against the validity of the court system by saying that the actual judicial system is endangering them. And if the circuit court upholds this, and if the Supreme Court does, I can't imagine the you know, apocalyptic reaction that is going to be generated from him. And, it, you know, this is not just coming from Trump. This is a very, very fertile field that the Republican Party has been tilling for pretty much half a century of any time a ruling on the merits of law goes against them, they decry activist judges who are legislating from the bench. And for people who love American traditions, they sure hate it when they're used against them legitimately. So Trump isn't the only person who's shouting this sort of thing. There is an entire, you know, 50% of the major political parties in the U.S. have been saying this for pretty much like living memory for most people. So nobody's going to say, hey, this guy crossed the line. Well, so a lot of people are going to say that, right? But there are going to be a lot of people who are going to just see him as being part of a greater continuum of delegitimizing anything other than what a Republican leader has to say. And that's really scary.
Well, this is good. If he gets rid of the courts, that's one less branch of government we have to learn stuff about and teach people in our civics podcast, Jeb. You've got to look at the bright side, man.
So two other things I just want to say really quickly. One, last week I completely spaced on the fact that the vice president can break the tie, which is stupid of me, because that's like fourth grade civics. That's not even high school civics. You know, like everybody learns that. It just seems so odd that that would even need to happen. And then, of course, it is like the fact that it happened is nuts. But then the second thing was, you know, the upholding this stay isn't unreasonable on a lot of bases. Like, it is extraordinarily chaotic, and it has shown that it misapplies or that it applies the American immigration and refugee system in wildly disparate manners. God, I'm like, get a sentence out, man.
we've been talking for a while, Jeb. It's okay.
And that's a legitimate challenge, right? So, like, if the law is unequally applied, just simply by the chaos of its rolling out, that could be enough to, and not the law, the order, enough to stay it. In which case, all the Trump administration has to do is just rewrite it in a more comprehensive and comprehensible manner. You know, again, this was something that the evil Steves, white supremacists Bannon and Miller, basically just sort of. You know,
Steve's such a hard name to make sound evil. So when you say the evil Steves, it's just like, it's a great gag.
They're like the two guys at the frat who just high five a little too hard. I mean, that's usually the evilest a Steve gets, I think.
Yeah.
So these guys went through and said, hey, you know, fuck the lawyers. We know better, and rewrote this thing. And basically, if they just run it through the lawyers or run it through some lawyers that actual sane people would hire, you know, this might come back in just a matter of weeks and be fully instated, and there won't be a whole lot we can do about it until there are actual harms, and you can take the proper functioning of the law and find a victim and then work through the court case that way. The other argument you can make is that, and perhaps this is what will happen, or what already did happen, is that Trump himself on the campaign trail starting in December of 2015, was calling for a Muslim ban. And then he keeps referring to this on Twitter as a Muslim ban. Yeah. So you
and
can
this
make
is what
the argument.
Sally Yates was referencing as well, that there was context for this. There was commentary. There were things that were stated before this executive order came out, which are coloring how to interpret it legally.
Exactly. So you can basically say, like, it, you know, we can ignore the implementation, unequal implementation of it. We can ignore the chaos. We can go right. We can drill down that the intent and like of the people who wrote the law. If you want to be an originalist scholar, the intent of the people who wrote the law was a Muslim ban, which is a clear violation of the First Amendment. It's done. And then that would be it would be very difficult for them to draft a new law, you know, that had the same effects without the same spirit being behind it. And in this case, it would be one of the few times that Trump's rhetoric on Twitter, apart from getting him on the news and provoking a lot of outrage from people who, you know, can't actually change anything, you know, this might actually get him into material trouble, so that'll be interesting to see, especially if it, you know, if for some reason he winds up muzzled a little bit afterward.
Well, only one way to find out. Tune in next week for another episode of American Dictator. Thanks very much, Jeb.
Thank you, Tim.
He's issued 20 or 21 executive actions since he took office, and it seems like we're covering one of them most days. I would love to talk to you about the human impact of opening up the Dakota and Keystone pipelines, of taking these...
It caused tremendous chaos and confusion at airports all around the world. There's now a court case with your Justice Department. It's probably going to take it all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. Of course it's a huge story.
No, it is, but there are other stories.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.